CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. And we're very pleased to be joined by our colleague, Jim Holmes. James Holmes is a professor at the Naval War College, writing most recently in the publication 1945. The headline, Europe and East Asia, all part of the same theater for America? Jim, a good day to you. The story of Ukraine since the beginning has been that this looks like a predicate for an invasion of Taiwan. There is nowhere written down that fact. It's just, again and again, a theme that I find, no matter whether the reporting is in London or Berlin or even Kyiv, and certainly in the U.S. and Japan, the predicate for Taiwan. Is that something that is commonplace now, Jim? Because I only know what I read from general publications. Is that the scuttlebutt? Isn't that the metaphor? Is that the scuttlebutt in the fleet that what's happening in Ukraine is a model for what China could do to Taiwan? Good day to you.
Gentlemen, always glad to be with you. You do hear it a lot. I don't think we have any proof of that. I think the word scuttlebutt that you use, which basically means hearsay, informed speculation, and so forth. I think that's the way to look at it. I mean, I tend to be skeptical of that. However, I mean, if you look back at history, there are times in which there has been a war in Europe or in Asia that was seen in Washington and allied capitals as, like you say, a predicate, sort of a feint or a precursor to doing something else in another theater elsewhere in Eurasia, such as during the Korean War when the Truman administration saw the invasion of South Korea possibly as a precursor to a major invasion, a massive invasion of West Germany in Europe, and therefore apportioned resources accordingly.
You write in 1945 the question, two theaters in one, Europe and East Asia. And you reference remarks by Kurt Campbell, the National Security Council's senior most Asia advisor. What is the debate, Jim? Help us.
Yeah, there was a perception that has taken hold among our European allies that Ukraine is a secondary theater for the United States. And Campbell's first started. He gave an initial set of remarks early on during the invasion that these were two separate theaters. Then he came back after being prevailed on by the German ambassador and said these are two parts of one indivisible theater. And that's a problematic thing when you're, I mean, look at the map. Eurasia is a supercontinent. If you define everything that happens in Eurasia as part of the same theater, you are saying that every one of those contingencies has equal claim on American resources. And you're basically saying that we almost have boundless resources in order to manage all these things. And that's really a dangerous and astrategic way of looking at things. You have to set and enforce priorities.
Gordon, you have a question for our friend.
Jim, your article is obviously right. A war in Ukraine and a war in Taiwan would be two separate theaters. But in defense of scuttlebutt, the idea that these are part of the same problem, I think, could very well be true, because you have Russia and China working very closely together. And we could see China taking advantage of the chaos in Eastern Europe to cause chaos on the other end of the Eurasian landmass. And so in a sense, although they are not the same theater, they are part of the same source of problems, and that is the Moscow-Beijing relationship. Your comments?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the right way to put it. If you want to consider this as an indivisible problem, it's, like you said, it's the same problem, namely authoritarian powers that are on the march. And if, in the case of Taiwan, we're always seeing this verbiage in the press that China has not renounced the use of force against Taiwan. It's exactly the opposite. As long ago as 2005, China wrote into Chinese domestic law its threat to absolutely use force against Taiwan if Taiwan crossed certain red lines as defined in Beijing. So definitely that's part of the same problem. I think in a sense that's a good way, because Xi Jinping must be watching the progress of events on the ground in Ukraine. And I think that perhaps Russia's underperformance is probably giving him pause. He's also probably a little bit worried about having formed this unlimited partnership with Vladimir Putin, who could be sort of a sea anchor around Xi Jinping's neck moving ahead. But yes, crossing the Taiwan Strait is a very, very difficult thing. And I think that's where our priority has to be, with Ukraine holding secondary priority, and which falls largely to our European NATO allies.
I want to look at the Pacific closely, Jim, because one theater, but the challenges would be to the arsenal of democracy, to resupply. You know the adage very well because you teach it. Tactics win battles, but logistics win wars. And the logistics favor us in NATO, favor NATO because of the resupply from all of our allies flowing into Ukraine. That does not look to be the case in the Pacific. We have Hawaii as the base of Indo-PACOM, but then there's this vast Oceania that is now in play because of the Chinese diplomatic effort and Belt and Road and money being passed around to develop civil military dual use facilities at Kiribati, for example, or at the Solomons, all of that. So the challenges for the Pacific seem vastly more complicated to me, an amateur, than the Ukraine matter of sending howitzers to the front lines in Donbass. Is the Navy struggling with that now? It would be its job to get the supplies to a contest over Taiwan.
Yeah, it's absolutely something that we're struggling with. It goes all the way back to the basics of having enough shipyards, having enough dry docks, having enough infrastructure of all types, not only to build but also to repair and sustain and maintain a massive logistics fleet. So, we spend a lot of time in the Navy and the Marine Corps talking about World War II in the Pacific, and that's because it's replete with lessons about this, including if you read up on what the service squadrons, what the combat logistics vessels. Not strictly military ships that carried fuel and ammunition and people to the theater. It was just a massive, massive, massive undertaking, and something that we've let wither on the vine a bit over the years, especially since the Cold War caused us to more or less breathe a sigh of relief and sort of stop putting attention into such mundane but absolutely vital capabilities.
Gordon, you have a question for Jim.
Jim, the Navy has been an extremely troubled institution, and we've seen this now for at least a half decade. You know, we've had the collisions with the two Arleigh Burkes, the destruction of the Bonhomme Richard in the shipyard, problems fielding ships. Where does the Navy stand in terms of restructuring itself and getting itself back to the ability to fight?
Yeah, the 2023 budget submission is before Congress now, and there's the conversation is starting to heat up about that. The Navy, the Biden administration has actually proposed shrinking the fleet in the coming years. In 2023, they want to retire 24 ships and build only 9 new ones to replace them. So it sounds like a negative 15 augments to the fleet right there. The justification to that is, well, if the top line, if how much the administration and Congress are going to spend on the Navy is fixed, then let's shed some of these these older and less valuable platforms so that we can afford to keep up the fleet much better and buy a lot more munitions to actually stockpile the fleet so that if things do go hot in the Taiwan Strait or the South China Sea or the East China Sea, we have lots of rounds that we can use to fire from the platforms that we retain.
I'm learning about the Navy and its budget, but I'm also learning about the White House and its remarks about Taiwan. Did the president change the balance a little towards the Navy with his remark that the U.S. will defend Taiwan militarily the other day? There's been mitigation of that remark, but it certainly seemed clear to me that we'll fight.
Yeah, perhaps so. I wouldn't make it just the Navy, but the Navy and the Marine Corps. I think that they were. This is what the Marine Corps' redesign is all about: is doing island warfare in the Western Pacific in concert with the fleet, basically returning the Marine Corps to its heritage as a literal offshore combat force that works very intimately with the Navy's fleet in places like the Taiwan Strait and elsewhere along the First Island Chain. So, if the president was serious about that, and I hope he was, then I think the answer is possibly yes.
One more detail: Guam. Is that the front line now for the U.S. Navy to both protect Hawaii and the coast of the U.S. and also to project into China in the event of a Taiwan invasion? Is Guam the front of the front?
Yes and no. I mean, we've all the way back to the late 19th century, we've looked at Wake Island and Hawaii and Guam as stepping stones. Basically, they used to host coaling stations back in the days of coal-fired ships. So I would, that's the metaphor that I would use, that the front line is going to be our bases in Japan and South Korea and elsewhere around the Asian periphery, as well as increasingly in Australia, but especially along the first island chain. So I would be putting most of my emphasis on that. Yes, we need to defend Guam. Otherwise, we break that chain of logistics bases leading back to the U.S. West Coast. But if you want to ask what the front line is, I would say Japan and South Korea.
One more minute, Gordon. Go ahead.
So, Jim, on Okinawa, in today's world, is Okinawa defensible from China?
Well, I think you'd have to talk to somebody from the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force on Okinawa. There's a lot of talk about, and there's a lot of worry about this, because you're talking about massive fixed bases that are easily targetable by Chinese ballistic missiles in particular. And that's another part of this Marine redesign, is the idea of dispersing forces along the first island chain, so that if we take hits, which we will, we won't lose all of our combat power at one stroke. So we could afford to lose, a light base elsewhere on the island or elsewhere along the first island chain, and then still fight on, which is ultimately the goal. So the answer is possibly no, the way we're currently configured, but we're trying to get this right.
One supercontinent, Eurasia, the world island. James Holmes, the first holder of the Wiley Chair of Maritime Strategy at the Naval War College. He's a blogger at the Naval Diplomat, writing in 1945 about not two theaters, Europe and East Asia, but one theater challenging the United States for the 21st century. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, Gatestone Newsweek in the Hill. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.